2016 was the hottest year on record so far. It has also marked a historic Indigenous-led protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. But Indigenous resistance, as you should be aware, apparent by now, didn't begin or end there. What did begin there was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's successful bid for Congress and an Indigenous-led movement that galvanized the popular forces behind the Green New Deal. And Standing Rock was part of a recent constellation of Indigenous uprisings across North America and the U.S.-occupied Pacific.
That's Nick Estes, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Nick Estes on Indigenous Peoples' Resistance. The history of Indigenous people is full of acts of resistance. One such dramatic action was the seizure of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay by activists from the American Indian Movement. November marks the 50th anniversary of that event. More recently, the blockade at Standing Rock in North Dakota galvanized Indigenous communities to defend their water and sacred burial grounds. The Standing Rock resistance injected into public discourse such terms as water protectors and stewards of the land, and an awareness that Native peoples have an expanded concept of kinship and family that includes nature. Despite widespread opposition to the pipeline, Trump authorized its construction. La lucha sigue. The struggle for Indigenous rights continues. Our guest today is Nick Estes. He's a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. He's an assistant professor in the American Studies Department at the University of New Mexico. He's co-founder of the Red Nation, an Indigenous resistance organization. His articles appear in The Intercept, Jacobin, Indian Country Today, and High Country News. He's the author of Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. He spoke at the Fourth World Center for the Study of Indigenous Law and Politics at the University of Colorado at Denver in October 2019. And now, Nick Estes.
I go a lot of places, and it means something really special to be welcomed by Lakota people. And I woke up this morning, and it was snowing, and it reminded me when I first went to Standing Rock. We were actually in Winslow, Arizona. Lori Alcina-Ginny was a 27-year-old mother, Navajo woman, who was gunned down by Austin Shipley, a white police officer. And we were at a memorial for her, and it was a hot, hot day. And we had just watched videos at Standing Rock. It was around the time of the dog attacks. And we were sitting there, and, you know, this family, L'Oreal's family, was mourning their daughter who was killed by this police officer. And there was no cloud in the sky, and we had a prayer song. And all of a sudden, it just started raining in the middle of the desert. And so when they say mini wichoni, water is life, it is life. And that day it was a female rain, right? And I felt like the gentle snow this morning was also, it was a female snow. It was a gentle snow. It was a cleansing snow. It was a healing snow. Denver is at the heart and the center of what we now know as Columbus Day, which is a made-up holiday, right? And I don't want to spend time talking about a mass killer and an enslaver, but instead I want to talk about Indigenous resistance. Go back to where you came from. A white woman screamed at us at the Los Angeles International Airport. We laughed at the absurdity of the notion. The biting humor of the late Haudenosaunee and Cree comedian Charlie Hill quickly came to mind. A redneck told me to go back where I came from, so I put up a teepee in his backyard. That sunny day in early 2017, we marched behind Tongva drummers, the original people of what is currently Los Angeles. We held placards that read, "No ban on stolen land," protesting Donald Trump's executive order barring travel to the United States from 7 Muslim-majority countries in Africa and the Middle East. This defiance is the living legacy of centuries of indigenous resistance, the active refusal to cede any moral authority over who belongs and who doesn't belong to this settler nation. But America only has room for winners or losers, we're told. And by that standard, Indians are the constant losers of history. And for that matter, so too is anyone who doesn't immediately buy what America is selling. The narrative we're sold is that indigenous resistance is a string of failures. That same year, water protectors lost at Standing Rock because the Dakota Access Pipeline was built. Later, the Wet'suwet'en lost at Unist'ot'en Camp because it had been raided by police and then occupied by Coastal GasLink pipeline workers. And more recently, the Kiai are lost at Mauna Kea because the mainstream media was obsessed with science versus culture, not indigenous land rights. And that Kanaka Maoli needed to relinquish so-called superstition and accept progress as inevitable by having a $3.4 billion telescope built next to 22 other telescopes on their sacred mountain. While indigenous peoples are told to quit living in the past, settlers are urged to make America great again by invoking this country's mythic halcyon days. That's the story America likes to tell itself. The story of winning the future of this land by winning its past. The truth is quite the opposite. America fears the past. Reduced to its basic components, the history of colonization boils down to three things: gold, God, and glory. Natives had all the gold, settlers brought God. Now the natives have God and the settlers have all the gold, the story goes. But glory is the most precarious element of this formula. Is there honor in invasion, slavery, genocide, and theft? The answer to that question changes throughout time. But we don't have to journey too far into history to see that the response by indigenous standards is clearly no. If anything, paradoxically, glory belongs to us, history's losers. In 1971, Richard Nixon ordered the police to evict Indians of all tribes from Alcatraz Island after 19 months of steady indigenous encampment in the former federal prison. The protest, however, is not remembered for its failure to achieve its stated goals of reclaiming the Ohlone land for all indigenous peoples and creating an all-Indian university. And by the way, this November will be the 50th anniversary of the Alcatraz protests, or the Alcatraz occupation. Instead, it is remembered for the movement that sparked an era of red power militancy. And Alcatraz resonated beyond the confines of just the indigenous movement. In 1969, a young black revolutionary who later took the name Asada Shakur visited the island offering her services as a medic. She marveled at the quiet confidence of the indigenous activist who had founded a new community, one based on their cultural and spiritual traditions, in and around what was once a notorious penitentiary. Shakur had discovered some of the current native occupiers were once former Alcatraz prisoners. The prison island was also the site where 4 Modoc were hanged and where Paiute and Apache prisoners of war in Western indigenous nations were imprisoned in the late 19th century for resisting invasion by the United States. In 1894, the military imprisoned 19 Hopi men at Alcatraz as punishment for refusing to send their children to government-run and church-run boarding schools. The indigenous prisoners of Alcatraz had faced similar conditions that Red Power activists had faced, a harsh landscape, purposefully isolated from the rest of the world, uninhabitable, abandoned, and in disrepair, much like the Indian reservations from which they had come. They, Indians, damn sure had the same enemy, Shakur recalled, seeing some similarities in black and indigenous experiences. She told her new comrades that if they ever visited New York, to look her up in Harlem. Sure, when are you going to liberate it, they asked her. Alcatraz catalyzed an indigenous movement that kicked off occupations of federal lands and buildings across the continent, the height of which occurred during the 71 siege at Wounded Knee, where indigenous activists took over the small a town of Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, demanded the ouster of a corrupt tribal administration and declared independence from the United States. And while a captivated public only saw the spectacle of militant Native men in braids and shades brandishing firearms, James Baldwin saw something else. What Americans mean by history is something they can forget, he said, reflecting on this period of indigenous uprisings. They don't know they have to pay for their history because the Indians have paid for it every inch and every hour. That's why they're at Wounded Knee. That's why they took Alcatraz, he said. And perhaps because they have paid such a heavy price for history, Natives have capacious notions of freedom and belonging. At Alcatraz and at Standing Rock, Indigenous peoples turned those seen as different into familiars, into allies. They made relations. This is the quiet strength, the victory of Indigenous movements over time, the power of love and humanity that doesn't make headlines. At the LAX airport protest in 2017, the Tongva drummers surrounded a Muslim family, singing them in an honor song. The singers welcomed them to their homelands. Tears streamed down a young girl's face. She wore hijab, and moments earlier she appeared frightened. Now at peace, this is what it means to go back to where you came from. Nothing about the complex human condition of shared grief, love, and solidarity is alien to that place of freedom. Call it home. So since the era of militant Red Power protests in the 1960s and 1970s, American Indian scholars have resolved a number of issues confronting what was at the time an emerging field of indigenous studies. First, indigenous perspectives on history, culture, and society are valid fields of inquiry. Second, they have emphasized the need to counter the racist, colonial orientation of previously written history and scholarship. Third, they have emphasized the temporal and spatial aspects of indigenous nationhood, that indigenous nations have existed with relationships to place and territory prior to the creation of settler states like Canada, the US, New Zealand, and Israel, and will continue to exist as nations in spite of such colonizing states. Fourth, they have given priority to interpretations by indigenous peoples themselves. A more radical version of this has been the concerted effort to entirely overturn European settler interpretations of hemispheric and continental histories that justify and legitimate the conquest of the Americas and its peoples to create a new world for European-derived nation-states at the expense of indigenous peoples, their lands, water, and air, and their rightful relations to this world. This work is the foundation of the proliferation of indigenous studies programs globally, and is responsible for the assertion that, as far as indigenous peoples are concerned, colonizers and European settlers are historically disqualified from interpreting indigenous peoples to indigenous peoples. And consequently, the phrase indigenous perspective has emerged as an anti-colonial theory and method. And here I'm thinking of the Mara educator Linda Smith's decolonizing methodologies. But an indigenous perspective is much broader than those of American history, culture, and society, or confined just to this hemisphere, for that matter. U.S. history is a branch of the larger tree of indigenous histories, not the other way around. It's a covetous, invasive branch that thinks it's the tree. An indigenous scholar naturally designates indigenous peoples, nations, and territories as the primary field of study. Yet sooner or later, unless one commits to a narrow field of study and thus narrow indigenous nationalism, an indigenous scholar is obligated to interpret histories, cultures, and societies beyond what is categorically defined as just indigenous to their own field of reference, territory, or region, or were still limited by the colonial state definitions of indigeneity that are confined by imperial borders and U.S. racial taxonomies that do not resonate elsewhere in the world. This latter aspect is an internalized U.S. exceptionalism and the acceptance of a colonial and racial definitions externally imposed onto us, our people and territory. And while the field of settler colonial studies advanced by the late Australian scholar Patrick Wolfe allows for the comparative histories of settler states, missing from the framework of the elimination of the native, which is his phrase, is the emancipation of the native by the native herself. While it is easy for settlers to imagine and live in a society premised on indigenous genocide and land theft, it is harder, if not impossible, for settler society to imagine a world that is not. Likewise, without internally derived theories and conspiracies of freedom my ancestors cultivated, imagined, and dreamt into existence, I would not be standing in front of you today. This substance of indigenous life, of futurity, so often missing in what our studies of death and destruction, are the necessary reminders that life need not always be this way. At least that is what our ancestors imagined. If not now, then someday. That was the threat, not merely biological reproduction, but social reproduction, the reproduction of theory and prophecies of freedom, of decolonization. And whereas colonizing nation states tend to exist in relation to each other, for example, Israeli settler colonialism is only possible because of U.S. settler colonialism, and in many ways an extension of it, liberation struggles also exist in relation to each other. Anishinaabeg theorist Leanne Simpson has called these formations constellations of co-resistance. Constellations exist only in the context of relationships, she writes. Otherwise, they are just individual stars. Indigenous nations exist in relation to each other, and so too do liberation movements. For example, a primary constellation of what white people call the Big Dipper, we have various names for it, for the Ocheti Shalkoi, represents the unity of our nation. Seven stars signify the Ocheti Shalkoi, the nation of the seven council fires, united by the assemblage of stars within and beyond the constellation itself, which represents the Chinupa or the sacred pipe, signifying the capacity to relate, to make diplomacy with other constellations and stars. And like allied fields of study, such as Black studies and ethnic studies, indigenous studies emerge from revolutionary movements across what W.E.B. Du Bois defined as the problem of the 20th century, a global color line that separated the lighter nations from the darker nations, the colonizer from the colonized. And while Black studies scholars have pointed out the necessity of interpreting a global Black and African experience, partially as a result of the colonization and the diaspora resulting from the transatlantic slave trade, indigenous studies in the global north has sometimes ignored its own radical origins, deeply entrenched in global solidarities of the time. Indigenous nationhood, likewise, is often misrepresented or misinterpreted as an exclusive project, the sole aspiration of just indigenous peoples. This is similar to the way the Indian problem is treated as solely an Indian problem, as if Indians themselves are solely responsible for the theft of their continent and their own genocide. It should be noted that structures of white supremacy and settler colonialism, while they do control the lives of the colonized, are also designed, first and foremost, to control the lives and behaviors of the colonizer. The terms indigenous peoples derives directly from an anti-imperial tradition and language developed by the United Nations or at the United Nations by Red Power activists. So over the decades, indigenous conceptually evolved from populations to peoples. The definitions are many, but they generally describe the colonial condition of statelessness of nations or peoples who existed prior to state formation and who have prior ties to territory and prior forms of political authority and governance that arise from that connection to the land. The term indigenous peoples is both paradoxically about the lives lived in the negative shadow cast by the colonial state and the affirmation of a prior and ongoing nationhood or people. Yet unlike other revolutionary actors, such as the working class or the proletariat, which according to some traditions seeks its own annihilation along with the ruling class towards a classless society, indigenous peoples seek not the annihilation of themselves or their identities to achieve liberation. Maintaining, elaborating, and strengthening indigeneity is the very vehicle through which they wage revolutionary struggle. That is not to say indigenous peoples are not engaged in a form of class struggle, quite the opposite. Indigenous peoples in this hemisphere represent the oldest and longest form of class struggle since 1492. It is therefore a temporal and spatial struggle of resisting erasure from history and maintaining relations with the land and other human and non-human beings, Indigenousness, as Susan Miller reminds us, is fundamentally a way of relating. A way of relating to the colonizer, which could be flight, fight, refusal, accommodation, or diplomacy, and a way of relating to our co-conspirators, human or otherwise. Some call this act of making relatives, of making those seen as different into familiars. That, to my mind, is the most profound aspect of indigeneity. Why let the colonizer interpret our histories to us? And why let them tell us who are our friends and enemies? In the aftermath of the American Indian Movement's or AIMS armed takeover of Wounded Knee and Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1973, state repression nearly crushed U.S. indigenous movements. The following year, the same Lakota elders who called upon AIM to take a stand at Wounded Knee called upon them again to take the issue of indigenous nationhood in the form of treaty rights to the United Nations. Meeting on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in June of 1974, the International Indian Treaty Council declared its intent to ally with the darker nations of the world. We condemn the United States of America for its gross violation of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty in militarily surrounding, killing, and starving the citizens of the independent Oglala Nation into exile, it read, in reference to the brutal crackdown of AIM following the occupation of Wounded Knee. The Treaty Council appealed to conscionable nations to join, quote, in charging and prosecuting the United States of America for its genocidal practices against the sovereign Native nations, most recently illustrated at Wounded Knee, and the continued refusal to sign the United Nations 1948 Treaty on Genocide. The declaration called for, one, the recognition of the United States' violation of indigenous treaties, two, the acknowledgement of the inviolate international relationship between Native nations and the United States, three, the restoration of treaty land, four, the eschewal of violence except in self-defense, five, the rejection of all legislative and executive acts since 1871, which was the year treaty making was abolished with the United States, and six, entry into international diplomatic relations with the United States and colonial states through UN recognition and membership. On the last day of the Treaty Council meeting at Standing Rock, Russell Means took the microphone. Throughout the day, he'd been reading various communiques from the Irish Republican Army, the Organization of African Unity, and several Arab nations in support of the Standing Rock gathering. There was some tension about the direction the Treaty Council would take. Most of AIM's leadership was still tied up in the courts from the Wounded Knee arrests, so how could the organization fight for recognition at the UN? More importantly, people who had no experience with international law or human rights were in charge of their destinies, but had no clue about the maze of UN processes. The path ahead was daunting and uncertain, and the tenor of the meetings were sober. Means stated that the Treaty Council must look to all potential allies, the United Nations, the Organization of American States, the Organization of African Unity, the Arab countries, the Communist bloc, and whatever is necessary for us to get our treaties in court, and would give the world forums a chance to hear us. Moreover, Means emphasized the historic character of the American Indian struggle as it related to the rest of the world. What we are into is revolution, turning that cycle of life always back, he said. It wasn't just about Turtle Island because, quote, in the history of the world, the successful struggles for independence and the struggles which are still going on for independence all involve land. Whether it's in Africa or Asia or Southeast Asia or the Mediterranean or the Middle East or in Ireland or in the United States or Canada or South America or Central America or Micronesia or Puerto Rico, he said. Now the Treaty Council had a global forum and allies worldwide. If we are going to struggle for our land, it can't just be with words, just with paper, Means solemnly declared. It has to be with our lives. In its publication, Oyate Wichaho, or Voice of the People, Dakota AIM frequently published interviews, short stories, poetry, and reports from Palestinians resisting Israeli occupation, even referring to Palestinians as relatives. Indigenous internationalism, as Means spelled out in his 1974 speech at the first Treaty Council meeting, was bound to the struggles of those fighting for emancipation of their homelands. And in the end, these alliances with the Global South and National Liberation Organizations proved the most productive for the Treaty Council. When the world turned its back on AIM after Wounded Knee, the world's colonized reached out and helped launch Indigenous peoples' rights to the international level. The International Treaty Council, or International Treaty Council delegations were directed to make friendly relations with other countries and to ask them to recognize the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. The delegations were received by their hosts, especially in the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc countries, who were eager not only to support Indigenous causes, but also to point out the hypocrisy of U.S. humanitarian intervention abroad while it denied freedom to its own people. Much like the European socialist regimes supported Black revolutionaries like Angela Davis, who was imprisoned by the state of California and later released, Eastern Bloc countries provided genuine transnational solidarity to American Indian struggles. And more importantly, where Indigenous peoples found hostile audiences in North America, they found welcoming audiences abroad, especially among socialist nations and other colonized peoples. The Red Nations of Europe and Asia had provided a platform of support for the Red Nations of North America. Treaty councils were frequent, and the relationships they fostered were lasting and deep. And while the Treaty Council brought the struggle of Turtle Island to the world also came to Turtle Island. International delegations were often guests of Indigenous nations in the United States, and Palestinian and Indigenous solidarity was particularly strong and visible. Both Palestinians and American Indians were unrecognized nations, stateless peoples who were fighting settler colonial regimes occupying their land. And at nearly every major Treaty Council event, Palestinians were in attendance. Solidarity isn't a fleeting moment. The Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS, is a form of nonviolent advocacy to pressure the State of Israel to end its occupation of Arab-Palestinian lands, to recognize the equal rights of Arab-Palestinians, and to respect the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homelands, as stipulated by UN Resolution 194. BDS, as it's known, has been endorsed by the American Studies Association, the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, two organizations of which I'm a member. So BDS is also partially inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement that helped to end apartheid. Indigenous peoples were made, and this is the connection that Indigenous peoples have to this particular struggle. Indigenous peoples were made a category in the UN decade to combat racism, racial discrimination, and apartheid, which began in 1974. And the decade gave a platform to Palestinian rights. U.S. presidents from Jimmy Carter to George W. Bush have boycotted the UN programs on racism, most likely over the questions of apartheid, South Africa, and Palestine. And this boycott included the two UN decades to combat racism and apartheid from 1974 to 1993. And we know the U.S. and Israel backed the racist South African apartheid regime when the rest of the world morally opposed it. The connections between South African anti-apartheid movement, Palestinian rights, and Indigenous rights cannot be ignored or dismissed. In 1977, the Treaty Council, upon achieving NGO or non-governmental status, called for an end of the celebration of Columbus Day and declared instead the International Day of Solidarity and mourning with Indigenous peoples. And that's kind of the genesis, actually, of Indigenous Peoples Day. It began as an international celebration. It wasn't just whether or not this city or that city would pass it, whether or not white people would feel, you know, not guilty on that particular day, but it was actually part of a global program, an international movement. The UN Committee on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Apartheid, and Colonialism passed the resolution with support of many organizations such as the African National Congress and the PLO, who recognizes the devastating legacies of European colonialism and African slavery had to be addressed in the Americas. In 1982, Spain and the Vatican proposed a 500-year commemoration of Columbus's voyage at the UN General Assembly. The entire African delegation, in solidarity with Indigenous peoples of the Americas, walked out of the meeting in protest of celebrating colonialism, the very system the UN was supposed to end. The commemoration was crushed, and the UN declared a celebration of World Indigenous Peoples Day and the decade for World Indigenous Peoples, which began in 1994. The second decade was, of course, declared in 2005. Without this lateral solidarity, Indigenous peoples would not have made such historic gains like the drafting of the 2007 UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And it should come as no surprise that Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States, all settler colonial regimes, initially voted against the declaration maintaining their decades-long position of hostility towards indigenous rights at the UN. And it should be noted that Israel was absent from that initial vote.
You're listening to Nick Estes on Indigenous Peoples Resistance. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
And so how does this connect to the particular movements that have erupted in the 21st century? Well, one particular moment in history is 2007, when global oil prices began to fall due to the North American oil boom. A crisis ensued, not just here in the United States, but also in Venezuela. And the money used to fund the social progress of that country's of the country's poorest was all but halted. Around the time that President Obama's pro-oil and gas energy policies began to take hold in 2008, global oil prices rapidly fell. This was partially due to the United States and Canada building new carbon infrastructure to drill and transport oil from production to market. The oil boom has wreaked havoc on Native nations. With the creation of oil pipelines, tar sands dead zones, fracking rigs and refineries, locking in settler economies to drill and drill at the expense of indigenous lands and lives. And meanwhile, the oil boom weaned the U.S. economy from oil imports from countries like Venezuela, which, by the way, has some of the largest oil reserves in the world, whose major buyer was the United States. But the alternative source of oil is much worse. And for those of you that don't know, the Keystone XL pipeline is transporting oil sands produced in the tar sands region of Alberta, Canada, which has created a dead zone the size of the state of Florida, right? So basically what's happening is there's an ongoing war. These pipelines, you know, if the Dakota Access Pipeline was the black snake, then all the pipelines emanating, Coastal GasLink, all those, Line 3, all those emanating out of this particular region, this region becomes the snake pit itself, right? And it's not just tied to drilling out the U.S. and Canadian economies. It's also about choking out the Venezuelan economies or countries like Venezuela. So Trump's new sanctions against the state-owned Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA, while not targeting U.S. oil companies like Chevron and Halliburton, reveal the true intentions of the United States' humanitarian intervention. It's not about democracy. It's about expanding the U.S. sphere of influence at the end of a rifle barrel. And for those of you that don't know, because of these sanctions, around 40,000 Venezuelans have died. So both the United States and Canada drilled their economies out of the gutter by producing the dirtiest oil in the world from tar sands and fracking rigs at the expense of indigenous lands. So each new proposal for new carbon infrastructure, such as oil pipelines, not only deepens the climate crisis, but it locks in carbon consumption, and it is also aimed to crush Venezuela. And so why target Venezuela? It partially has to do with its oil reserves, but it also has to do with the threat that it poses, an economic and social alternative to neoliberalism. Venezuelans voted the Bolivarian Revolution into power, which in turn increased the participation in social, economic, and political life of indigenous peoples, women, LGBTQ, Africans, and poor people. The nation's oil wealth was redistributed to the lowest sectors of society. And while for a moment the U.S.-backed coup to oust the democratically elected president of Venezuela seemed imminent, people took to the streets and the countryside to defend these hard-fought gains. Far from a perfect model, as if there is ever such a thing, the Bolivarian Revolution represents a possible alternative to neoliberalism. And Venezuela's solidarity has also extended to indigenous nations of Turtle Island of North America. In 2007, Tim Guiago, a preeminent Oglala Lakota journalist, applauded Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution for providing heating assistance to hard-hit Indian reservations, the poorest places in North America on the northern plains, during the harsh winter months. Citgo Petroleum, a Venezuelan state-owned oil company, has for nearly a decade donated millions of dollars of heating oil not only to reservation communities in the United States, but also to low-income Black and Chicanx neighborhoods and homeless shelters. Guiago excoriated the United States' hypocrisy for failing to uphold its own treaty obligations while criticizing other countries such as Venezuela and the failure of capitalist indigenous economies to keep indigenous people warm and fed. Where was the rich casino-owning tribes? Guiago asked, busy counting their money, I guess. So the gravity of enforced reservation poverty hit home this winter. when Donald Trump shut down the federal government for 35 days to force construction of his border wall with Mexico. Federal jobs and funding, which come in the form of treaty obligations, keep indigenous families afloat. Without them, families face a choice of food or heat. So prominent Ojibwe activist from White Earth, Winona LaDuke, has also made the connection between the war on indigenous nations in Turtle Island and the economic war waged against Venezuela. In 2016, during the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, she told Democracy Now! That the construction of DAPL has to do with crushing Venezuela, because Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. So 2016 was the hottest year on record so far. It has also marked historic indigenous-led protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. But indigenous resistance, as you should be aware, apparent by now, didn't begin or end there. What did begin there was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's successful bid for Congress and an indigenous-led movement that galvanized the popular forces behind the Green New Deal, legislation that she introduced with Senator Ed Markey earlier this year. Ocasio-Cortez was herself a water protector, having visited the prayer camps, and Standing Rock was part of a recent constellation of indigenous uprisings across North America and the U.S.-occupied Pacific, such as Unistoten Camp in 2010, Keystone XL in 2011, Idle No More in 2012, Trans Mountain Pipeline 2013, Enbridge Line 3 in 2014, Save Oak Flat in 2015, Protect Mauna Kea in 2015, Nihil Be Ina in 2015, and Bayou Bridge in 2017, among many others. And the question that I think that Standing Rock and all of these movements ask is, why is it easier to imagine the end of fossil fuels, but not settler colonialism? To imagine green economies and carbon-free wind turbine, solar power, and electric bullet train utopias, but not the return of indigenous lands? And it shouldn't be an either-or scenario. The question of restoring indigenous lands to indigenous people is thoroughly political, which means the theft of it was and is not inevitable or beyond our current capacities to resolve. The same goes for reparations, ending U.S. border imperialism, and the continued exploitation of labor and resources from the global south by countries in the global north. The issue is that accumulation-based societies don't like the answers we come up with, because they are not quick technological fixes. They are not easy, Leanne Simpson again said in a recent interview. So 50 years ago, decolonization, nations freeing themselves from colonial rule, and land reform inspired global visions for a just future, advancing the class struggle further than it has ever gone by raising the living standards of billions in the global south. A new green economy, one that will be, if indigenous peoples have anything to say about it, a caretaking economy, is the antithesis to a militarized extractive economy or a capitalist economy. If prisons, police, and the military are caretakers of violence, then educators, healthcare workers, counselors, water protectors, and land defenders are caretakers of human and non-human relations. All we need to do is compare the pay gaps between carceral and military workers, who are mostly men, to that of care workers, who are mostly women, and you'll see the value of this current system. And this caretaking economy is already in place. 3/4 of land-based environments and 2/3 of marine environments have been affected by capitalist development. But environmental degradation has been less severe in places managed by indigenous peoples and local communities, a UN report recently found. And while making up only 5% of the world's population, indigenous peoples also protect 80% of the planet's biodiversity. Indigenous peoples and local communities who have distinct cultural and social ties to ancestral homelands and bioregions still caretake at least 1/4 of the world's land area. This includes places that are the lungs of the world, such as the Amazon rainforest, which are on fire, and its veins, like where I'm from, of the Minnesota or the Missouri River Basin, areas facing existential threats of deforestation, damming, water contamination, oil and gas development, and mining. Indigenous peoples protect the land, air, and water we all need to live. This is why indigenous environmental activists are so severely criminalized and targeted for assassination in response to our organizing throughout the world, we are always in the way. In the United States, indigenous caretakers have been the most confrontational arm of the environmental movement by blocking the construction of oil pipelines. The flurry of new federal state laws specifically targets this tactics. Following the Standing Rock protests, 8 states have passed ALEC, or the American Legislative Exchange Council, inspired critical infrastructure laws criminalizing the protesting of pipelines. New legislation proposed by Trump would make inhibiting the operation of an oil pipeline, simply standing in the way of construction, an offense punishable with 20 years in prison, to say nothing of the water protectors such as Red Fawn and others who are currently serving time. The North American oil boom in particular has intensified militarized assaults on indigenous land and water to protect the expansion of the oil and gas drilling and pipelines. And the most spectacular confrontation with law enforcement and private security contractors occurred at Standing Rock in 2016 and 2017, when water protectors protested the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so infrared footage of the protests captured by police drones, which was leaked by the media collective Unicorn Riot, conjures scenes familiar to the U.S. war on terror. In the video clips, teepees are the only objects that distinguish water protectors from the horrific but recognizable aerial perspective of a drone stalking military-age youth in Yemen or partygoers at a wedding in Afghanistan, the collateral damage of U.S. surgical strikes. Drone strikes on the state-owned Saudi Aramco facilities recently kind of demonstrate a different kind of connection, right? Tim McMillan, the president of the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, said the current situation in Saudi Arabia may provide more incentive to expedite projects like Keystone XL and Enbridge's Line 3, which would carry more oil from Alberta to the U.S. And the reason why he's doing this, because if anyone remembers, within those drone strikes, right, these are people in sandals that knocked out 10% of the world's oil production. The U.S. and these Canadian oil lobbies saw this as an opportunity to actually ram through these pipelines because they're like, look, it's going to be destabilized, and so we need to get this oil, this lion-locked oil. So McMillan added that even with President Donald Trump pushing these pipelines, quote, it has been a challenge with the U.S. court system and some of the other delay tactics that opponents are currently using. And Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau plans to use Canada's oil and gas development as a way to build the green economy. Indigenous peoples are not the alternative. We're just in the way, and Spice, who's a Tlingit water protector, recently told me. The Wet'suwet'en territory she helped protect has been invaded by police and pipeline workers whose presence has disrupted the local indigenous economy of hunting and gathering, primary food sources for a place that still relies on subsistence food. And now we are not only in the way of oil and gas expansion, she tells me, we're also in the way of transitioning to a green economy. So while I've kind of laid out a lot of problems, right, I think going back to the original premise of this talk was perhaps the answers lie within kinship relations between us and the lands we both inhabit as native and non-native people. Making kin is to make people into familiars in order to relate, writes Dakota scholar Kim Talbert. This seems fundamentally different from negotiating relations between those who are seen as different, between sovereigns or nations, especially when one of those nations is a militarized and white supremacist empire, she says. So if there is a future for indigenous peoples and indigenous studies, it cannot be invested in the future of America. America has no future, so we must return to our radical origins. It's an existential challenge, one that must begin to inspire and draw inspiration from the humble people of the earth who are taking action to turn back the forces of destruction. The IPCC recently gave us 12 years. But I'd add that we've been at this for 5 centuries, and we'll be at it for 5 more if that's what it takes. Thank you.
After the conclusion of his lecture, I had a chance to talk with him. Nick, talk about the First Nations, as Native peoples are called in Canada. There's a huge movement against the Trans Mountain pipeline from Alberta to British Columbia.
Yeah, so the First Nations folks have been at the forefront of resisting the construction and the expansion of these oil pipelines and carbon infrastructure, but at the same time, because of the Truth and Reconciliation process, they've also been brought into the negotiations with these pipeline companies, and in some instances, buying interests into the pipelines and benefiting financially from them. And so it kind of coincides with the ways in which Trudeau has bought oil pipelines as a way to, quote unquote, nationalize the energy infrastructure to provide the capital necessary to transition to green energy economies. And so many of the Indigenous communities who have constructed blockades or the tiny house warriors that people like Conas Manuel are leading up really stand in the way of not just the oil and gas industry, but according to the Trudeau administration, they're also standing in the way of the transition economy to a green economy.
And beyond Canada, what kind of connections or alliances do Indigenous people here in North America have?
So just, I mean, if you even take the idea of Canada and the fact that it owns about 60% of the mining companies throughout the world, it connects us simply by the fact that the things that they're doing to Indigenous lands here, they're also doing to Indigenous lands elsewhere. And so TC Energy, which was formerly TransCanada Energy, has actually built oil and gas pipelines in Mexico. And so in that sense, we're fighting the same enemy. We have the same kind of issues with the oil and gas industry. However, there's also been connections, like, for example, there's been a lot of connections with the kind of like Anglo-Pacific and like the Maori, the Kanaka Maoli, and the Polynesian indigenous folks who are on the islands. But there has historically been kind of a hemispheric idea of indigeneity throughout the Americas, and the fact that we were only separated by borders that weren't of our own making. And so there is the prophecy of the eagle and the condor, the South American indigenous peoples uniting with the North American indigenous peoples. And I think in the Southwest, where I'm from, and where we're at right now, actually, there you can see the kind of the residue of those alliances. So if you look at the Greater Chaco landscape, for example, which is a sacred site to many dozens and dozens of indigenous nations that aren't only in the United States, but also in Mexico and further down into Central America. And what's fascinating about that landscape is that Hopi, Navajo, and Pueblo people have a legal claim to protecting that particular sacred site, but people who are on the other side of the border who also have ties to that sacred site don't have any legal claim or standing. And this translates not just to the connection to sacred sites, but that entire landscape, the Greater Chaco landscape, actually extends all the way into Mexico and Central America. It's part of one contiguous series or archipelago of sacred sites for indigenous people, showing the unity in cultures, and not necessarily the same culture, but an understanding, like a kind of like a patchwork of various cultures that were integrated and reliant upon each other. And colonial borders have only served to sever those relations. And so what they don't say, for example, in the concentration camps that have been built to house migrants, is that the majority of those people are indigenous people, right? And therefore that is an indigenous issue, but it's not being framed as one.
And in terms of Standing Rock, it has, and the resistance there, it has been described as a seminal moment in terms of disparate nations coming together to fight the power.
It's exceptional in that sense because it's new in the 21st century, but historically it's what we've always done. Even if you think about basketball tournaments, the Ocheti Shalkoi comes together every single year for basketball, right? We come together as a nation, the Lakota Nation Invitational, which is the largest gathering of Native people on the Northern Plains for basketball. So we have these cultural ties around sports, also around powwows, but in this particular context, the Ocheti Shalkoi as a political confederacy didn't just include the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people, but it also included the Winnebago, the Ho-Chunk, and other people. It was always about Lakota actually means, or Dakota actually means, friend or ally. It's derivative of the word kola or koda. however you say it. And so it's part of our tradition as indigenous people to make alliance and to make relatives that way. And so in many ways, it was a continuation of that. But it cemented, I think, in many people's minds, the idea that there needs to be a unified indigenous movement in this particular moment, and not an indigenous movement that's exclusive to indigenous people, but that incorporates and makes alliance with other non-indigenous peoples and movements, and that these aren't just quote-unquote indigenous struggles, but that they're actually struggles that affect us all. We all need air to breathe, we all need water to drink, and we all need healthy land to live on, right?
In terms of cultural representations, have you seen some breakthroughs beyond the cliches and stereotypes that so many of my generation grew up with, for example?
What's happening now is that Native people are making their own media. And hasn't really broken mainstream media, but the reason why Standing Rock became a mainstream headline, you know, protest is because the media makers who are on the ground, like Digital Smoke Signals, the people who are live streaming, the people who are doing the drones, all of that stuff, that was indigenous produced media. And the joke of it all is that after Standing Rock, all of Native America became friends on Facebook, which is really funny, but it's true. And so in that sense, you know, it's these kind of like informal channels of social media that a lot of us get our news from. And they're actually in many ways more accurate than what mainstream media is portraying. And actually mainstream media is finally somewhat slowly catching up to the kinds of issues, accurately portraying the kind of issues that face contemporary Native people. So I think when we look at like the issue around like Elizabeth Warren, or like, you know, Trump's derision of Elizabeth Warren as quote unquote Pocahontas, there's a tendency to flatten out the indigenous experience in Native America, or collapse it into one white individual's idea of what Native people are, who Native people are, or one sports team's idea of who Native people are. So in that sense, we're still battling those things, but those things are related to the theft of indigenous lands. They're not just things that exist in people's minds. They have real material consequences in the real world for Native people. So how we understand indigenous people is important to how we address the issues and the demands that they're making for justice.
And what's happening on the reservations in terms of the economy? Growing inequality, of course, is a hallmark of this particular period of capitalism.
So it's not just reservations. 4 out of 5 Native people don't live on Indian reservations in the United States, which doesn't even include the people who aren't counted as indigenous. So the common experience is to grow up off reservations. So this idea that reservations are rural, isolated pockets of poverty may be true in some instances, but by and large, Native people are experiencing levels of extreme poverty and inequality and all the social ills that come along with that in places like here in Denver, which is rapidly and aggressively and violently gentrifying, right? To the point that the indigenous communities that traditionally lived here, historically lived here, can't even afford to live here anymore. And many of them make up the most extreme paradox, but they make up the majority of a good size of the homeless population, right? So these aren't isolated issues out into some, you know, rural geography. They're actually concentrated in urban centers like Denver. And as we know with the Murdered Missing Indigenous Women's report that has come out this year, it focused specifically on urban centers because that's where the majority of murdered and missing Indigenous women cases occur. So if Native women are targeted at higher rates for homicide and kidnapping and violence, that's not occurring. It is occurring on the reservation, but not to the same degree or intensity as it is occurring off reservation. And so that's the real challenge that we're facing right now in the 21st century.
And finally, what gives you hope?
It's cliche to say young people give me hope, but they really do. They are the new voices of this movement. They're the leaders of this movement, right? They're the ones who are advancing the kind of cutting edge theory because they're the ones who are, you know, whether it's a Standing Rock or whether it's the new climate justice movement or even the youth runners, you know, that took.
Explain what they.
The youth runners are the people who brought the word of Standing Rock to the rest of the world. They ran 1,000-mile relay runs from Standing Rock to Washington, D.C. and back in 2016, and that really galvanized the movement, right? And so if we think about who is really leading this climate justice movement, I would say that Indigenous youth are at the forefront, and that's what gives me hope.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, David.
You were just listening to Nick Estes on Indigenous Peoples' Resistance. He gave a talk at the University of Colorado at Denver in October 2019, and I spoke with him after the event. Nick Estes is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. He's an assistant professor in the American Studies Department at the University of New Mexico. He's co-founder of the Red Nation, an Indigenous resistance organization, and he's the author of Our History is the Future. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media organization Rise Up. We feature such progressive voices as Winona LaDuke, Russell Means, Angela Davis, Kianga Yamata Taylor, Dar Jamail, and Ralph Nader. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Professor Glenn Morris. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.